Ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In the name of Father Coughlin and all those associated with him, I wish you a happy and holy new year. This afternoon's address will be the ninth discourse which Father Coughlin will have delivered over this microphone this year. Because so much controversy has arisen and so many unfounded charges have been leveled against Father Coughlin for his previous addresses, thousands of persons are now asking, what did Father Coughlin actually say? Are the charges true that he is anti-Semitic? Or that he is pro-Nazi? There is a definite answer to these and other questions. To afford you access to these definite answers, Father Coughlin has printed a book containing all the addresses which he delivered over the microphone this year, including the one he will deliver today. Together with his 9 lectures, there is also printed in this gift book a statement of more than 40 pages on the question of atheistic communism written by Pope Pius XI. One copy of this book is free to every lady and gentleman in this audience. Hundreds of thousands of persons are anxious to acquire this well-bound book containing all these addresses. It is yours for the asking. It is the answer to all controversy on what was said and what was not said. To secure your copy of the book, please write this week directly to Father Coughlin, not to the radio station, but to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Whether or not you can afford to make even a small contribution to defray the expenses of printing this book is irrelevant. It is for rich and for poor, for everybody. Write your name and address plainly. Your order will be filled as quickly as possible. This afternoon's address carries a message of great importance to every American. It unveils information which is not generally known to the American public. While the Little Flower Choristers will sing for us the Shrine Lullaby, adapted to the melody of Brahms' composition, you will do a favor to some friend or neighbor if you telephone them during these next 3 or 4 minutes and ask them to be sure to listen to this afternoon's broadcast.
Star above, a shrine.
Once more, may I inform you that a book containing all the discourses delivered by Father Coughlin this year is yours for the asking. This book can be obtained at no bookstore. It will not be for sale. The only place where it can be obtained is by writing directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. There is no charge for this book. It is for rich and for poor, irrespective of your ability to help defray the expenses of its publication. Father Coughlin is now prepared to speak to you on the subject of Americanism, neither Nazism nor Communism.
Good afternoon, my friends. The occasion of a New Year's discourse seems to suggest that we take inventory of the past and establish firm resolutions for the future. The old year has gone. It has vanished, as have the hopes which ushered it into being. The new year is born. Although it falls heir to the disappointments and heartaches of 1938, nevertheless we hope that it will be a wiser year. A year that will not only recognize the shortcomings of its predecessor, but will carry us forward towards peace and prosperity. For almost 20 years, the world has been passing through a cycle of political and economic change that has been alarming to all patriots and Christians. Immediately following 1918, we witnessed the liquidation of several old forms of government. Russia repudiated its czarism. Italy accepted a rule of fascism. A few years later, German imperialism, after passing through the experiment of democracy, bowed before Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist Party. Other nations evolved other changes, as in the instances of Turkey, Portugal, and China, and still others held fast to the general pattern of their democratic traditions. As a common denominator of all these dictatorships, either forcefully imposed upon the people by a very small minority, as in Russia, or freely accepted by them, as in the clear-cut case of Portugal, as a common denominator, we find their origins traced to economic causes. In every instance, the leaders and their followers who established a dictatorial form of government at the sacrifice of civil rights and liberties did so in order to obtain economic liberties which had been denied them. In every instance, the blame for insufficient food, clothing, and shelter was attributed to the old form of government. Thus, to obtain a sufficiency of life's economic necessities, individualism was discarded and replaced by a form of collectivism. To accomplish this change, it was thought that a new form of government must supersede the old. This twin revolution in politics and economics was accompanied by a social revolution which was manifest in two extremes. I refer to the internationalism of communism and to the supranationalism of Nazism. The proponents of the former, seeking a worldwide revolution, have as one of its main objectives the complete destruction of all nationalism and religion. The advocates of the latter support a theory of race superiority and individual nationalism, to which is subordinated the supranational activities of religion. The year 1939 is not a new year in the sense that we have entered upon a new cycle. The next two or three years will witness the completion of this era, whose last phase will be unfolded during this present year, a phase which will witness a mortal combat between communism and Nazism. As we enter 1939, we find civilization roughly divided, politically speaking, into three conflicting camps: the internationalism of communism, the extreme nationalism of Nazism, and the traditional democracy, for example, of America, whose teeming population is justly dissatisfied in its citizens. On every hand, nations are either at war or are busy arming against the inevitable day when communism and Nazism meet in a battle unto death. Russia boasts that it has 20 million soldiers, together with ample resources, planes, munitions, and supplies, to defend the principles of communism. England, France, Germany, Italy, Belgium are working feverishly to equip their nationals with instruments of defensive and offensive war. Spain is engaged in the most gruesome and destructive internecine struggle of all times. China and Japan are pursuing the undisturbed course of an undeclared war. Propagandists in all neutral nations are bending every effort to have their governments commit themselves to the side either of communism or of Nazism. Spokesmen, both official and unofficial, in our own country, are intimating that we too must prepare to take sides in this impending struggle, favoring either communism or Nazism. Pause to examine more closely the attitude of democratic America as we face this crisis. Unfortunately, many of our citizens entertain the opinion that American democracy must be sacrificed in order to gain economic security. More than that, these persons are willing to make definite commitments in favor of Nazism on the one hand, or of communism on the other. Another group, influential in finance, radio, press, and cinema, refuses to participate officially as a group in counteracting the spread of communism, but is most vigorous in condemning Nazism. This perilous condition is deplorable, for no true American can entertain favor for either communism or Nazism. No true American can refrain from forcefully condemning both these excesses, cost what it may, and no intelligent American can conclude that to obtain economic redress, we must sacrifice our democracy. However, we must face facts as we find them. We must admit that the pro-communist sentiment in America is in the ascendancy, if we believe the public opinion poll conducted by Dr. George Gallup. This condition was brought about chiefly through the instrumentality of newspaper and radio propaganda, together with shallow thinking on the part of those who were exposed to it. To promote this insidious campaign for enlisting the mass of Americans to favor the Moscow plan, our people are being deluged with accounts of Nazi atrocities, and scarcely a word is printed regarding communist murders. However, just last week, a local paper printed an official summary of the communist murders in Spain, informing its readers, in an inch and three-quarter article, that 12,500 ministers of the gospel of Christ were murdered by the loyalists, supporters of Stalin. 3 weeks previous to this, this same paper and others published articles, page upon page, lamenting a $400 million fine imposed on 600,000 Jews by the Nazis in Germany. Another paper insinuates that he who is an anti-communist, even though he is also an anti-Nazi, is an anti-Semite. Our people are told incessantly that communism is a form of democracy, that fascism and Nazism are outright tyranny. But Americans are seldom warned that both these un-American forms of government must be stamped out peremptorily. They are seldom advised that the free speech of the communist or the free speech of the Nazi may not be used to destroy the free speech of the American. In face of all this, I ask you calmly, what of Americanism and our democracy? Is there no one to defend them? While the popular mind has been poisoned by the lethal gas of propaganda, we have witnessed the birth of numerous organizations against Nazism which are powerful and efficient. We have observed that personal derision has been poured upon every individual and organization established to oppose communism. And we have looked in vain during the past years for the appearance of a consolidated, determined organization to stamp out both of these irregularities and support the traditional democracy of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Jackson, for which our ancestors suffered and died. Again, I ask you, is there no one to defend Americanism? Must the attention of sincere Americans be focused constantly upon these un-American heresies? Is it not time, this New Year's Day, to organize courageously against both communist and Nazi in our own nation and drive them and their unconvertible supporters into Russia or Germany where they belong? 1939 and the years immediately following will witness the completion of the present cycle in which we are living. A cycle which will culminate only with victory for communism, victory for Nazism, or victory for Christian democracy over both. The two political systems of totalitarianism, one a dictatorship of international godlessness, and the other a dictatorship of national race supremacy, one a thoroughgoing form of atheism, and the other a thoroughgoing form of state control of religion, one a notorious butcher of Christians, and the other a notorious disparager of Jews, these two cannot exist together, nor can either one of them live within the confines of our nation, side by side with Christian democracy. Christian democracy, the regime of national liberty founded upon the moral code of God the Father and His divine Son, Jesus Christ. The United States of America is not large enough for both democracy and communism or Nazism. Therefore, it is to be hoped that this year will find the inarticulate, easygoing, and long-suffering American public divorcing itself from the influences of propaganda and asserting itself most vigorously against communism and its atheism, against Nazism and its exaggerated ideas of nationalism. Let us stand undivided for American Christian democracy, even though this will necessitate stern action against the highly organized forces which are endeavoring to destroy our ideals, forces endeavoring to substitute for them either the brazen, godless internationalism of the Kremlin or the supernationalistic theories of Berlin. Americans fought a civil war to preserve the unity of this nation. How many Americans are there this New Year's Day who are willing to engage in a more important civil conflict, if necessary, to preserve the democratic liberties of this country? Let those who are with us reap the rewards. Let those who oppose us by their silence or their actions suffer the consequences. These are militant words, I recognize, but it were cowardice to evade a definite issue when we witness already the first results of the premeditated destruction surrounding us. Before discussing the hysteria which is impelling our nation to participate in the worldwide race for supremacy and armaments, and the tendency to cast our lot with the policies and destinies of foreign dictators, permit me to speak of the Munich Peace Pact and the events leading to it, for it has a bearing upon our future. The most important single event which characterized 1938 was the Munich Peace Pact, and the most important man of the year was Neville Chamberlain, Premier of Great Britain, who made possible this pact. Immediately prior to the signing of the peace pact, the American press and radio shed oceans of tears over the possible partition of Czechoslovakia, which slowly but surely was being communized by a band of atheists. Little or no publicity was given to the press or radio to Cardinal Kaspar's pastoral letter. Cardinal Kaspar, the primate of Czechoslovakia. In pathetic words, this venerable gentleman said, quotations, "In this country, Czechoslovakia, God was affronted by the pulling down of the memorable statues in the midst of our capital city. Idols were displayed before the nation for the worship as the redeemers of the people. Prominent public leaders dared not even mention the name of the true living God and our Savior Jesus Christ in their utterances. I do not wish to recall all that was done at that time to de-Christianize our nation," continues the Cardinal, beginning with the youth in the schools, "but it is a comforting fact that many people have since found and acknowledged those mistakes." Unquote. My fellow Americans, why did the press and radio deluge our nation with professional lamentation on the occasion of Czechoslovakia's partition? Was it their purpose to arouse our sympathies for an oppressed minority? Or was it their design, if possible, to have England, France, America, and Russia declare war against Germany? A war that would be safe in a degree for the agitators 3,000 miles distant from the battlefields, but gruesome for the populations of Europe. Even though the partition was an injustice to be condemned, what complaint did this same press and radio utter when the godless rulers of this victimized country stole the liberty of religion from the hearts of its people, scarcely a word. No wonder then that Cardinal Caspar concluded his pastoral letter by stating, quotations, "Was it not a heartbreaking announcement that was made at the International Godless Congress recently in London that Czechoslovakia comes next after Soviet Russia in the number of organized godless propagandists," unquote. Holding no brief whatsoever for the German acquisition of a portion of Czechoslovakia, which portion nevertheless was predominantly German, but merely referring to this incident which led up to the Munich Peace Pact, the year of 1938 in American propaganda will be remembered for generations to come because of all this propaganda. Because of it, we were almost constrained to believe that England, France, Russia, and the United States should declare war against Germany for this so-called aggression. Fantastic suggestions were heralded throughout the nation, intimating that our own national security was in jeopardy, that the British Empire was on the verge of collapse, unless 20 million men should sacrifice their lives or their fortunes to sustain the godlessness of which Cardinal Caspar officially complained. We will also remember that above the din of this hymn of hate, there emerged the clear, courageous voice of Neville Chamberlain, which re-echoed the angel's song once sounded over Bethlehem's stable. He refused to be stampeded or coerced by the propagandists. He chose peace, recognizing the futility of war which settles nothing. To him and his cabinet, more than to any other group of men in all this world, does this generation owe its gratitude. Had his mighty office as premier been occupied by a fashion plate of radicalism, a world war so greatly desired by the communists and by their international supporters would now be in progress. As a result of Chamberlain's action, communism experienced a tremendous reversal in Europe. It was only a reversal, however, not a defeat. A reversal which necessitated a change in their plans and tactics. Thus, from Europe to America, their base of operations was quickly moved. To gain control of our America became the objective of the international radical. To liquidate our democracy and substitute for it a dictatorship became their goal. Only America, so they decided, could turn the tide in favor of Stalin. Only America could force the retirement of Chamberlain and his policies. Only through the capture of this nation with its finance, its industry, and its power, could there be realized the dreams of Antichrist. America, so they believe, even now can force Britain and France to engage in a world war to assure an international victory for communism. My friend, if communism and Nazism must come to grips, let America remember that she is beholden to neither one of them. Let America remember the golden counsel of her first and greatest president, which warns us today, as it did yesterday, to keep clear of foreign entanglements. In these days when, according to propaganda, one is un-American, if he is American, one is anti-Semitic, if he is anti-communist, it might be worthwhile to revive a paragraph or two printed in the Congressional Record of February 9, 1917. In one sense, 1939, with its violent pro-communist propaganda, and 1917, with its outrageous atrocity stories, are somewhat related. In 1917, the late Senator Carraway wrote into our official government records a statement which reads as follows, quotations. In March 1915, the J.P. Morgan interests, the steel, shipbuilding, and powder interests, and their subsidiary organizations got together 12 men high up in the newspaper world and employed them to select the most influential newspapers in the United States, and a sufficient number of them to control generally the policy of the daily press of the United States. These men, continues the article, these 12 men worked the problem out by selecting 179 newspapers and then began, by an elimination process, to retain only those necessary for the purpose of controlling the general policy of the daily papers throughout the country. They found it was only necessary to purchase the policy, national and international, of these papers. An agreement was reached, the policy of the papers was bought, to be paid for by the month, an editor was furnished for each paper to properly supervise and edit information regarding the questions of preparedness, militarism, financial policies, and other things of national and international nature considered vital to the interests of the purchasers, unquote the congressional record. That, my friends, is a part of the propaganda story of 1917. The parallel in 1939 is evident. While no one is intimating that the house of J.P. Morgan and Company, or any other financial house, is advocating the cause of communism through the press, 1939 will witness a very definite and determined effort on the part of a certain group in America to pervert our democracy into a dictatorship, this to be accomplished through those who control the press through advertising. Be it submitted that a strong minority of the American press will remain American through and through. However, I am warning against only that group of publications which is willing to sacrifice patriotism for profits and nationalism for internationalism. To most of you, this prediction appears to be the utterance of an alarmist. Let me assure you that it is founded upon congressional facts. Its substance is founded upon several congressional bills already prepared or in the process of preparation for passage during the forthcoming session of Congress. At this moment, the citizens of the country are being conditioned to favor one of these bills by means of the propaganda of preparedness, of militarism, and of fear of persecution, which is being spread abroad throughout the nation. While we readily admit the necessity of being prepared to wage successfully a defensive war, while we are glad that a suggestion made over this microphone 4 years ago to the effect that we should have at least 4,000 planes on the East Coast and 4,000 more on the West Coast is at long last receiving attention, what nation, I ask, will be our aggressor? Not Japan. Too many thousands of miles separate us from the Orient. Too many hundreds of ships would be required by the Nipponese to transport 1 million men with their necessary equipment and food and munitions. Not Germany. Russia's 20 million troops would seize an opportunity long awaited if 1 million German soldiers were to leave the soil of the fatherland for offensive warfare in North or South America. And not Great Britain. This is a friendly nation. Our deputies are students of war for any serious activity to originate from that quarter to cause our destiny. Why then is 1939 ushered into America with a fanfare of militarism? America that is almost self-sufficient. Now they cover his arms, brother, his arms with and friendly arms with South America.
Defense of warfare, must we conclude that we are preparing for an offensive war? Let us weigh this question. To it, there is only one of two answers. First, it may be a plan on the part of the government which has failed to break the back of the Depression through consumer expenditures to launch a gigantic campaign of producer expenditures. In other words, the policy of extending doles to the farmer, the laborer, and the jobless has failed. Now, expenditures for destructive purposes, for battleships, munitions, fortifications, and military equipment, this will be engaged in to give work to the idle, satisfaction to the warmongers, profits to the munition manufacturers, bonds to the bankers, and joy to the hearts of those who are laboring under the impression that we are preparing to launch an American armada of destruction against Germany, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. The second answer, the more likely reason for all this propaganda for military preparedness and war expenditures, originates with those powerful internationalists who are determined to line us up with the communists in the impending European war. They have consistently sympathized with the policies of Stalin. They have not only constantly attacked the policies of Hitler and Mussolini, but they have unremittingly endeavored to picture American democracy as an obsolete form of government for which there should be substituted a centralized rule controlled by those who control the nerve centers of the nation. These are they, so I believe, who are most responsible for the war hysteria. The embers of this hysteria have been fanned into flame recently by the propaganda of persecution. A persecution which in reality never equaled by 1/1,000. The atrocities which were perpetrated against the millions of Christians trampled to death under the steel heel of the commissars of Russia. Nevertheless, it was a convenient persecution, even though it was unjust. Beneath the cloak of outraged justice, therefore, that was so well publicized recently, the international warmongers hide the sword of revenge. Even though the cost of unsheathing it will entail the destruction of countless properties, the loss of millions of lives, and the dissolution of American democracy, what care they? My friends, have we not learned that modern wars settle no disputes? By this time, are we not disillusioned? Do we not realize that wars are the enemy of democracy? Do we not appreciate the poor men, the laborers and the farmers? They pay for all wars, pay with their lives and with their liberty. And I ask you, shall we engage in another European war to make the world safe for Stalin and for Antichrist? Recollect that during the World War there was more actual increase of centralized power in Washington than in the previous 100 years and more of our government's existence? Oh, how many of those who lived during that day remember what Thomas Jefferson said? The World War perhaps was in his mind when he spoke that those who soon desire international war would soon want bread. How many of those who applauded our entrance into the World War lived to soon want bread, lived to become wards of the federal government on the WPA? During the time of the World War, many different things happened to centralized government at Washington. During that time, there was set up
a chairman of the War Industries Board, a member of the Advisory Commission of National Defense, and chairman of its Committee on Raw Materials, Minerals, and Metals, who, according to his own confession, held more power probably than any other man of that day, Mr. Bernard Berry. The parallel of 1939 to 1917 becomes more apparent when we review the several bills soon to be presented to Congress for the purpose of centralizing again all power and industry and commerce and American activity in the hands of a small group of unelected men at Washington, with possibly Mr. Baruch as the presidential appointee to supervise the so-called military preparedness. I have before me a House of Representatives bill number 9604, popularly known as the May Bill. It is one of several bills of the same ilk favored by the present administration for passage during this coming session. It is divided into 11 sections and reads in part as follows. Section 1, that whenever Congress shall declare war, the President is authorized to determine and publicly proclaim it to be unlawful to buy, sell, lease any article at a higher rate of rent, price, commission, or compensation than was in effect at a date or dates determined in the proclamation. In other words, this bill gives the President of the United States the absolute and sole power to set prices and determine profits. Section 3 of this bill states that during such time of war, the President is authorized to determine and publicly proclaim from time to time the material resources, industrial organizations, public services, security and commodity markets over which government controls, including requisitioning materials, shall be necessary. This bill, therefore, plans to give the President full power to commandeer, requisition, seize, and confiscate all material resources which, in his judgment, shall be required by the government. Section 4 of the bill gives the President power to draft an army. Section 5 gives the President power to register all individuals engaged in the management or control of any industrial establishment designated by him for the duration of the war and to live according to his regulations. And Section 6 reads, during such time of war, the President is authorized from time to time to determine what classes of public service, real and personal property, or rights or interests therein, and what classes of owners, dealers, exporters, and importers, manufacturers or producers of any article, shall be required to operate or to be operated under licenses. In other words, this is the superlative dream of a Moscow mind to license every industry and business and profession. It empowers an individual with the control of every gainful activity from the manufacture of a warship to the selling of a bag of peanuts. And Section 7 of this proposed bill gives absolute dictatorial power to the President to determine the priority in which any owner or manufacturer or producer or farmer shall fill his orders. The same dictatorial power once enjoined by Joseph Stalin and his predecessors when they forbade food to be shipped into the Ukraine because the Ukrainians were not favorable to the Soviet policy. Section 8 of this proposed bill reads, as used in this act, the term, quotes, in time of war, unquote, shall mean the time intervening between the declaration of war by Congress and the passage by Congress of a resolution stating that war has terminated. My friends, this is startling information to the majority of you who are living in a fool's paradise, imagining that this democracy of ours is unassailed from within its own walls. When on the very doorsteps of this year 1939,
four or five similar bills to the one which I have condensed for you are prepared to destroy, prepared to haul us into a hell of war on the side of communism and to establish a dictatorial form of government. A form of government which, upon the passage of this or a similar bill, goes into effect not when war is actually engaged in, but when war is even declared. Even a war declared against the cotton pickers in Alabama or the Eskimos at the North Pole region. Please, God, may these be idle speculations. However be they founded on fear or fact, one policy is certain for Americans. Let us serve notice on the internationalists in this nation that we respect Washington's counsel of no foreign entanglements, that henceforth we will observe strict neutrality, not permitting the stars and stripes to fly from a ship's masthead that carries munitions in her hold, that we will not infringe upon the laws of good neighborliness by repeating our recent error of loaning $25 million to China, now engaged in war with Japan, and that we will not permit young radicals to be regimented here to fight for the cause of communist Spain. And let us seal that resolution by informing them that this is a democratic country which we will never surrender to a dictator. And at this juncture, may I pause to inform you that of all the nations in the world supporting or recognizing the communist loyalists in Spain, there are only three, namely Russia, France, and the United States. Every other nation of importance, including Great Britain, the largest, and the Vatican State, the smallest, has recognized General Franco's government either de jure or de facto. Again, I ask you, is there no voice to be raised for America and democracy, for America and for our traditions? And my answer is most assuredly there is. There are millions of God-fearing, American-loving citizens who are neither joiners nor factionalists. Men who are content to sit serenely by their firesides with their families. Men who in a crisis will prove the bravest of all. Those men and their families will rise during this year of 1939 to keep America safe for Americans, and the stars and stripes, the defender of God. So this is 1939. Possibly, yes, probably, Europe will be in war by 1940. The forces of Nazism and communism will clash in mortal combat. America must stand aloof. At home, there are still 12 million men out of work. We will not liquidate them by teaching them how to manufacture poison gas or shrapnel, or by dressing them up as targets for enemy machine guns. Or rather, 1939 will mean for us that we will turn our minds to solving the industrial and agricultural problems which confront us according to the pattern of our Constitution. From European wars, America must stand aloof. This is 1939. As yet, the billions of dollars loaned to Europeans to conduct the last war remain unpaid. We will not loan these nations more billions and more lives and reap more death, more depression and loss of democracy. From European wars, America must stand aloof. This is 1939. Now we are being conditioned to take sides either for or against communism, for or against Nazism, with scarcely a word spoken in defense of Americanism. Oh, when shall Americans cry down and sample the propagandists and turn their attention to America? From European wars, America must stand aloof. In 3 or 4 weeks, possibly 3 or 4 months, the opportune time will arrive when every citizen who stands for Americanism, for the Constitution, and for liberty must be prepared to support his congressman in walking out of existence the dictatorial military bills which are now prepared on the pretext of national defense. 1939 finds Americans standing at the barricades of liberty. Behind us stretch 162 years of freedom, and before us yawns a vortex of national doom. Behind us are 5 generations of civic and industrial growth. Before us beckons the specter of commercial decay and industrial slavery. Behind us have rolled 16 decades of religious freedom under the Bill of Rights and democracy. And before us stands, gaunt and threatening, the auger of irreligion, of hate, and of war. My fellow citizens, it is within our power to make the future of America as glorious as the past. But the future depends upon the answer to this question. Shall we participate in a European war and degenerate into dictatorship? Or shall we organize to preserve democracy, our Constitution, and keep clear of foreign entanglements? In its current issue, the Brooklyn Tablet says today editorially, war advocates and international meddlers will be particularly active in Washington next week. A lift the embargo and Spain convention will be held. In addition, the American League for Peace and Democracy, an outfit which, like the late Mr. Custer, hides its racket under an assumed name, will convene and engage in its usual activities of promoting communism through attacking fascism, thus misleading the public. The general theme of the 2 conventions will be to lift the embargo on Spain. Just now, when our nation tenders its sympathy to the persecuted minority in Germany, these zealots have the effrontery to demand that arms and ammunition be sent to the persecutors of Christians in Spain. The advocates of collective security, the stooges for Stalin, demand that we act to save a tottering regime that has denied every human right to the Spanish people and murder them, may I add, by the hundreds of thousands. My friend, this is America. Year 1939. A reawakened America. An America that stands 100% for Americanism. An America that is opposed to both Nazism and communism as traitorous heresy. An America that will have no patience either with Nazism or communism. An America that still stands by the traditions of our forefathers, traditions of liberty, traditions of godliness, traditions upon which we must establish a sane Christian nationalism. From European entanglements, I pray you. From Nazism and communism, I conjure you. America must stand aloof.
and her future is secure. This address, my friends, will be incorporated in a book, which I have prepared for distribution, the last 9 lectures, together with an essay written by Pius XI on atheistic communism. The book is yours, free for the asking. Write to me this week. God bless everyone.
Once more, may I remind you that a book containing all the discourses delivered by Father Coughlin this year is available to every person who asks Father for a copy of one. Read this book carefully and judge for yourselves whether the charges leveled against Father are true or false. Because many hundreds of thousands will be requesting a copy of this book, please ask for one copy only in each letter. Write your name and address plainly. Whether you can contribute towards the expense of this book or not is beside the point. It is for every person interested in truth. Father Coughlin is fighting communism. In doing so, he necessarily offends those who are communists or supporters of communism. Together with his 9 lectures, there is a statement of more than 40 pages on the question of communism written by Pope Pius XI. This papal statement is included in Father Coughlin's book. Mail your letters directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Until next Sunday afternoon at this same time, this is your announcer, on behalf of Father Coughlin, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and in no way reflect the policies of this station. Your dial is set at 1,250 kilocycles. This is WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.